time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
If you're hungry, summer isn't so much fun. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Nationally, some 48 million Americans live in food insecure households. That's 32.8 million adults and 15.3 million children. Here in Maryland, there are more than 760,000 people who do not have enough to eat, according to the Maryland Food Bank. Indeed, they say that 39% of the food insecure people in their service area qualify for federal or state relief. This morning, we're going to take a look at the local effort here on Delmarva. In our studio this morning, we have Zach Evans. He's with the Wicomico County Fair. Also, he's with Mid-Atlantic Farm Credit. And Chris Bitters, he is the general manager for the Delmarva Shorebirds. And we should be joined shortly by Jennifer Small, who is the managing director for the Maryland Food Bank. So welcome to the program, first of all.
Well, thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Let me turn to you, Chris, because you've had a thing called a strikeout for hunger. Tell me, first of all, a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was a program that the Shorebirds, we were fortunate enough to host the South Atlantic League All-Star Game in 2011, a game that featured players like Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, and obviously our relationship with Purdue. We really wanted to take that event and turn it into a community program. Obviously, everybody's going to see great ball on the field, but how do we take a showcase event that we're hosting and turn it into bring attention to something that's so much needed in our community? So we decided to create the Strikeout Hunger campaign tied to the All-Star Game and obviously focus here in Delmarva, but we also expanded it to focus on all 14 teams in the South Atlantic League throughout the East Coast. With that event, it was very successful. And the goal of it was not only to raise funds, volunteer hours, and food, but also to find an opportunity to have other people get engaged and utilize their businesses or their events to also help us strike out hunger in our communities with our three food banks here on Delmarva.
So, and how long has this been going on then?
So, since 2011. Uh-huh. And we've continued, obviously, we don't host the All-Star Game every year, but we provide fans the opportunity to bring food donations on Sunday games to the ballpark to receive discounted tickets. And we get tremendous response from that, as well as our partnership with Purdue and the food banks. For every strikeout a Shorebird player, a pitcher strikes out an opposing player, Purdue donates $10, obviously, to our local food bank, and then also challenges our food banks to raise a certain amount of donations and matches that as well. So it's an exciting program.
And you've designated, or at least in the past, I think you've designated something like 11 Sunday home games. And what kinds of things do you talk about, folks bringing some kind of non-perishable foods? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, every Sunday home game, you can bring non-perishable food items. If you bring two non-perishable food items, you can receive a $3 general admission ticket. So you're saving $5 off the normal ticket price. And what we find, actually, is a lot of people, I think a gentleman the other day only needed one ticket and brought 18 cans of food. So the goal is, obviously, the people get the great discount to come out and enjoy a ball game, but also it gives them an outlet to do some good in their communities.
I want to turn to Jennifer Small, who's joining us. She's the managing director of the Maryland Food Bank. And tell me, I just sort of want to step back a little here from the events. How serious is the situation with, I guess, what is now being called really sort of food insecurity? Both nationally, but also here on the shore.
I think locally, if we look at the Eastern Shore area, and we service 8 counties here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, food insecurity is at a rate of about 47,000 Eastern Shore residents. 17,000 of those are children. So I think even more staggering is the fact that 1 in 7 adults, 1 in 5 children have no immediate access to food.
And so what kinds of people are we talking about?
We're talking about individuals just like you and I. The stereotype of hunger has completely changed over the last several years. It's no longer the homeless individual that we used to be accustomed to understanding. It is now the working, what we call the working poor, the blue-collar workers who are out really trying to stretch their dollar between prescriptions and mortgages and putting food on the table and clothes for school, et cetera.
So in terms of we've had the Great Recession, which obviously put a pretty big strain on food pantries. Has that situation eased up as the economy has picked up, or what are you seeing? I mean,
we're still seeing some of the effects of the economic downturn. A lot of people are really holding on to those shelf-stable products that used to be accustomed to coming into the food banks and the emergency food pantries. They're also able to access places like dollar stores and Family Dollars because they can continue to move that type of food without retailers taking a loss. So partnerships such as that which we're experiencing with Purdue, with the Delmarva Shorebirds, and now through the localized fair, we're able to collect food items that are now going to help restore what we're not seeing coming in on a regular basis.
So what is a typical family like then who comes in? I mean, or some example comes to mind, because you see these folks coming in all the time.
We actually are touching them a little bit more locally through our network of 167 emergency feeding programs. They really get to see the end user or the client. And as I stated, these are families that are very strapped for resources, and they're really kind of at the end of how are we going to be able to support our family, and with a very basic necessity that we all kind of take for granted right now, which is food.
What is this? I mean, we've talked about the fact this is families. This obviously affects children. What kind of impact does this have on children? I mean, I'm assuming that there are like lunch programs, certainly for school, although obviously if they're not in school during the summer, that falls by the wayside. What kind of impact does that have on a child?
It's extremely aggressive. During the summer, over the past several years, we've worked to engage with programs that can help at least provide breakfast and lunch. During the school year, we all know that if a child is hungry, they're going to fail to concentrate while they're in school. So it impacts grades. It impacts how they feel, their health, what they're able to retain as you continue to grow, because now we're seeing a lot more in the high school and college age group. You know, then you have your success rates of graduation and forward movement into the workforce. So it impacts multiple facets of an individual's life.
Does it is it embarrassing for children?
I would say we probably don't see it as often because we don't always recognize the signs. But, you know, a lot of children more recently are saying, well, little Susie, for example, is coming in always grabbing her stomach, and she opened her bag and there was nothing in it. So they don't like to recognize the fact as young children because of embarrassment. But I think as adults and educators, what we need to do is just recognize the signs. And then through the emergency feeding programs within the school pantries, then we can start to help to alleviate that locally.
Zach, I want to turn to you. You're with the Wicomico County Fair. Tell us about your involvement with this.
Yeah, so the fair was really excited, and we're looking forward to the opportunity to sort of partner together with this awesome initiative that's been in place since 2011 here on Delmarva. The fair is a relatively new event. This is our second year, and we had a conversation early on with the food bank and with Purdue and with the Shorebirds to talk about the best way to possibly engage folks. You know, the fair is a free event. It's free admission. It's free parking. But we're really trying to stimulate community involvement and community participation in any program that sort of addresses major issues and concerns we have here on Delmarva. So the Strike Out Hunger campaign is just one example, but we think it's a wonderful example. And the venue that we're going to have through the county fair is an excellent opportunity for folks who are looking for a family-friendly, fun activity that weekend to come out and participate in. But also, if they're interested in becoming involved and participating in some of these programs through the food bank, through the Shorebirds, and through Purdue, we will have drop-off locations right there at the front entry, and we are strongly encouraging folks to please bring non-perishable food items. Any donation is appreciated, and we're just really excited to have the opportunity to sort of further promote this program and use our event as sort of a soapbox to bring more awareness to this big issue.
I want to ask you this, Zach, and I'll also ask Chris as well. I mean, both of these are large events, obviously, the Shorebirds events, your event. People are walking around, they're buying things, oftentimes they're expensive food that they're buying. And does it occur to anyone as you walk around these events that there are people who can't even afford the kind of food that you're just buying at this event? I mean, is there a disconnect, do you think, for us?
That's a hard question, and it's tough to ask, but I think you make a very compelling point. You know, part of what we try to do as a nonprofit with the fair is we try to make all of our activities and our entertainment free and accessible to everyone. But you're absolutely right. You know, we are promoting local products, and we'll have food vendors there, and we'll have folks participating. So what we try to do is we recognize that a lot of those food vendors are individually operated and owned small businesses. And we try to have them price things competitively, and we try to offer a wide sure. range of access to food. Through that, I think that there's things that are affordable to most folks, but you do hit on a great point. It's, you walk a thin line because you're trying to bring awareness to this issue. But you also recognize that some of the constituents you're representing and some of the participants you have at the fair may very well be the folks who are suffering from this issue. And based on the statistics that Jennifer has provided us, it's very likely that a lot of our attendees, are suffering from food insecurity.
What about you, Chris? I mean, I've been to the games. I've had a few beers and some hot dogs. I mean, it's all very, it's a nice place to go and so on. But there are a lot of people, say, outside that stadium, probably not maybe even far away, but can't enjoy that. I mean, obviously it's something that we go through our daily lives. And we're busy with our business and with the things we have to do. But
yeah, I think that's absolutely the whole point of what we're trying to accomplish here, with the Shorebirds and other events, and encourage other businesses, is that obviously if everybody was well connected to every issue that was out there, particularly as we're talking about food today, we probably wouldn't have a problem. If everybody was connected as acutely as they should be to what's going on in our communities, we wouldn't have this conversation today, because Jennifer would have so much food she wouldn't know what to do with it. So that's the whole goal of what we're trying to do, is utilize people that do have some disposable income that are attending events like ours. They obviously have money to come out and buy tickets, buy a soda, hot dog, whatever it may be at the ballpark, and making those folks aware that, hey, we have a problem in our community, and here's how you can help. You can help by coming to a game. You can help by having your business or an organization you may be familiar with put together a food drive at your office. Maybe do something fun with them at your office. And so the goal necessarily isn't just coming out to a Shorebirds game. It's to bring awareness to these facts that are out there, and utilize a large-scale organization like the Shorebirds to put that in front of people on a regular basis, on a daily basis, and so that maybe some action will have take place. And a guy that owns a business in town may call Jennifer and say, hey, can I get some containers? We're going to run a month-long food drive at our office and ask our employees to bring stuff in for a month to help out with this cause. And that's happened, and that's the great thing that's came out of this over the last 5-6 years that we've been doing this now, since 2011, is that other organizations have done this. I've got a buddy that runs a business that does a mac and cheese drive. So he encourages employees to do mac and cheese stuff. I've seen other ball clubs now do mac and cheese events where they actually have people bring the macaroni and cheese boxes, use them as noisemakers, and then at the end of the night, be able to donate those to the food bank. So it's, it makes a novel event out of something that now we were really impacting the people in our community. So there is definitely a disconnect, because if there wasn't, we wouldn't be needing to do all these efforts.
I want to turn to you, Jennifer. How aware do you think people are that there are people who are in need of food?
I think we're probably more aware than we were several years ago, before a lot of these conversations took place. There is a great need. It's something that's going to take many, many years to try and correct. Our mission is to work collectively with community organizations to fight the need. And I think we need to continue to rally around that and continue to offer events such as both Strike Out Hunger and the Wicomico County Fair, to use them as catalysts to really propel the message.
Do you think that people are all that aware? I mean, as I've indicated, obviously at the events, but I mean, just generally speaking, we go about our lives. We don't really think too much about it. We're worried about bills and so on and so forth, or our kids in school. That's just a part of life that we don't really connect with. And I'll say, by the way, I remember I did a piece on hunger and the food banks and so on a few years ago. And I remember going down to a church where they were distributing food, and there was a boxes and so on and so forth. And I remember talking to some of the people there, and this was like a regular event that they had to go down and pick up food. In one case, there was a gentleman who I think had been out of work for about a year or two. He had worked at a shipyard, and you could tell that after a while this was really tough for him, and especially coming down to a place where they've been independent all of their lives, and then suddenly they're here with a bunch of other folks in a church getting food.
It's very difficult. I personally have been on that side of the line. So I can probably say a little bit more firsthand that it's ever more real, and it's very important. And I think it becomes a community. I think it becomes a community issue that we all really need to prioritize. And I think we also need to realize that those things that we take for granted on a day-to-day basis, like food, for example, there's that individual in the Lexus pulling up in a parking lot that still does not have access for food. And I think where a lot of individuals take the wrong direction is we stereotype. That one individual may have had a family member that passed away, and that's all they have, and they're living in their vehicle. And we see that on a very real basis. And I think those are the things that we just have to keep at the forefront is how can we rally around the need and what are our best resources to access food to help with food insecurity here on the Eastern Shore and throughout the state.
You mentioned a moment ago that you had your own personal experience with. What was that? What was the circumstance, if you can tell me, and a little bit, and what was that like? I mean,
it was very humbling. I will say that I was in a corporate management position. I was going through a very serious separation with a one-year-old little child. And I had a job lined up that would be conducive to being able to take care of my son. And then that job disappeared because of funding resources. Now, I do live in another state, but at that particular moment, having moved out of a company that was closing and laying off to having no resource whatsoever, and because of having retirement funds that are supposed to be for retirement, I had no access to any type of federal assistance. And a lot of our clients that we see are just over that federal poverty line, so they have no immediate access to stretch the funds that they have. So here I was over a period of time banging on doors and trying to figure out what am I going to do, eating Vienna sausages and saltine crackers from the dollar store because that's what could stretch because my son needed food on the table. So it's very real, and it's something that you don't have to be poor to experience. You just hit hard times, and food tends to be what we push back to the back burner.
I mean, going along, particularly, you mentioned a moment ago that you had this corporate job that one did not envision that you would ever be in such a situation. Is that a traumatic moment where is there a realization that what's happened to you, that this is not part of the life, then you might be educated, you might have all these tools and skills and so on, and yet here you are? I mean, is that a traumatic moment? Is there a single moment that you realize it, or?
I think it's ongoing. And I think as an individual, you fight and you fight through it. And I'll say this, in the 7 years that I have been the director with the Maryland Food Bank, I have had many a call from fathers, from mothers, from grandparents, from legal guardians, of families struggling that they woke up one morning, everything was great, and they came home in the afternoon and their whole world had been turned upside down. And there becomes this desperation of how am I going to take care of my family? And I think we all realize that at one time or another in the course of our life.
So, Sturdy, you're young. You've got a whole life ahead of you. You have no idea what will happen between now and you retire. Has it ever occurred to you that you could find yourself in that situation?
I think, you know, that's one of the things. And when food is available, when you have access to it, when it's prevalent, when it's on the forefront, it certainly is not one of your primary concerns. And Jennifer makes a very compelling point. I mean, we all do so much to plan for our financial future, and we take preventative health measures, and we have savings, and we do a lot of things in other facets of our life to make sure that we've got a backup plan. But I think we can only start making those backup plans when you have access to your basic needs, food, clean water, shelter. So when one of those immediate things is all of a sudden not accessible, I don't think a lot of us have a backup plan. And as a young person, you know, I'm not married. I don't have children. You know, I'm supporting myself at this point, but it's certainly not something that I've ever, you know, considered. I haven't thought of what would my backup plan be. And you know, we're lucky that there are resources both at the county and state level here on Delmarva that folks have access to. But it's very eye opening and it's frightening, quite frankly, to think of. Just as an individual who's responsible for myself, I couldn't imagine what it's like to be put in that position where you have the responsibility of feeding a family or, you know, of taking care of others. So it's definitely a scary situation.
What if, by the way, a couple of quick questions for Jennifer. There have been some cuts in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program over the years, particularly the austerity budgets that have come out of Washington. Has that had an impact on how you're trying to deal with this? So you see more people because of those cuts, or can you tell?
We've actually received more calls for referrals over the past 2 years because of the national cuts, and having engaged in several conversations with individuals that benefit from those types of resources. You know, it's very hard when 30% of what they were accustomed to having each month is all of a sudden gone. So again, it becomes that creative means is how are we going to stretch what we do have over a monthly resource and get what's best and what's going to sustain. And that's why those shelf-stable box canned goods are very important. And luckily, during the produce season, we have a lot of farming support here on the Eastern Shore. Purdue supports us not only through events such as Strikeout Hunger, but through protein availability. So we're able to offer protein and fresh produce now, where we used not to be able to do that several years ago.
The other question I have is, there's a conference, I guess, in Virginia at this point, who's the rallying cries for $15 for minimum wage, that kind of thing. Does that sort of increase have an impact, do you think, on families being able to afford food? Some kind of increase in wages, whether it's the minimum wage or what have you. I mean, and obviously it's been a big push. I mean, Walmart, I think, has gone to 15.
And I think when you look at the family dynamic, that increase in minimum wage, although extremely important, I think those dollars end up going to other needs before food. I think food takes the back seat when it comes to where we need to put our financial capacity.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Small. She's the managing director for the Maryland Food Bank. Also, Zach Evans. He's the Wicomico County Fair Chair, as well as with Mid-Atlantic Farm Credit. And Chris Bitters. He's the general manager for the Delmarva Shorebirds. I appreciate you all stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hope you can join us this Friday at 8:30 for the very last edition of Vintage Country with me, Tom Pittman. April Fools, no, it will not be the last edition, but it will be the April Fools edition. Hope you can join us. We're going to have a lot of fun here on WSDL.
It's called the Knapp Center, and within its walls is the history of the peninsula. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The region is the site of the oldest continuous set of historical records in British-speaking America. Knapp Center, located on the campus of Salisbury University, contains documents that go back as far as 1630. The center officially opened in 1982 and was the product of efforts by Ray Thompson and Sylvia Bradley. Since that time, the center has grown from a file cabinet into an archive where students and the public can delve into the past. In our studio this morning is Ray Thompson, who is retiring this year. So we thought we might take a look back at the center's history, its archives, and its significance to the Delmarva Peninsula. And welcome to the program.
Morning, John.
So take us back here a little as to what was the concept. Well, how did this come about, this idea that you would archive all of these documents? And do you have any idea that you would eventually wind up with all the kinds of documents that you now have?
Well, no, we didn't have an idea that we were going to be able to get the kinds of records we have initially. What started this whole thing was back in the mid-70s, as you are aware, the college at that time was changing from a teacher education college to a more comprehensive liberal arts college. And many of our students in the history department who were interested in getting history degrees were not interested in getting teaching degrees. So we thought we should create a curriculum that would allow them to have that opportunity. So Sylvia Bradley and I began our quest to create a new curriculum in public history. And at the same time that that happened, it just so happened that I made this what I think was a serendipitous discovery of the oldest continuous records in British-speaking America right here on the shore, something that I didn't know and something that no one had ever said to me that was the case. What really caused that was my discovery that even though I came here in 1972 to teach ancient Greek and Roman history, my ancestors had lived here on the shore from the 1620s, and I didn't know it. So I began looking at the records, and the records of one county led to the records of another county. And finally, I found myself down in Northampton County, Virginia, with the oldest continuous records in British-speaking America. So that's basically how it started.
So so tell me then a little bit about the relatives that you found, and what was your reaction when you discovered who they were?
Well, it was a real shock to me. The way this happened was we had just purchased a house, having decided we were going to move and stay here in Salisbury. And we were taking things out of boxes, putting on the shelves, and discovered a Bible that had belonged to my grandmother. As I put it on the shelf, something fell out on the floor, and that something was an obituary. I picked it up, and it was a lady named Sarah. It was an obituary of a lady named Sarah Elizabeth Kelly Ennis. And as I read it, I discovered that was my great-great-great-grandmother. And I thought, she was born in Snow Hill in 1824, and I am only like 20 miles from that and didn't know it. So I began going to the various courthouses looking for records, and that really started my understanding that these records were of great importance and could be used not only for people studying family history, but for studying the history of colonial America and certainly of the region.
So you began with, I guess, a file cabinet, as I sort of alluded to. So how does this expansion take place? And I know you had some microfilm machines and so on. I mean, people seem to come along at various times to kind of allow you to expand.
That's exactly what happened, Don. We had a great cadre of support from the community and region, and always have had. But when people in the region began to hear about our creating this new public history concept at the college, they were interested, and people began to come out of the woodwork. Some people had purchased microfilms. Another person had a microfilm machine, which they donated. So Sylvia's office and my office became not only our advising offices, but basically the Delmarva Historical Archives Center, and more and more materials came in. So from the very beginning, both students, faculty, and members of the community have been a real important part of this undertaking. So what really happened was I began to go out to speak to groups, and sometimes as many as 50 different talks a year over the four-state region, plus teaching full-time. And there was always a very positive response. People would give things. We had people who began to give their own books. If they no longer needed them, they would give books on local history to us. So we began to create a large collection of local history materials, and that led us to eventually the view of Dr. Wilcom Washburn, who was the head of the American History Museum of the Smithsonian for more than a quarter of a century. He and his wife had a home here on the shore, and he gave us 13,000 volumes of his records. So that was a wonderful beginning. From that time on, we have had probably 70 or 80 collections of monographs, which have been donated to us, the last of which was a 5,000 volume collection that came from a man in Connecticut whose ancestors were here from the shore.
So you started a small office, but explain a little bit about your expansion and where you are, which, of course, we should say, studios, you're right next door, but as I understand, will not necessarily be there.
Right.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that expansion.
Okay. Well, from the two offices on the third floor of Holloway Hall that we had, we were given a suite of offices on the second floor of Holloway Hall, which now is the Public Relations Publications office. That had five rooms in it, and we had, in addition to Sylvia and myself, a graduate student who worked for us. That lasted for several years, and it was very convenient for both students and for the community to come and use the material. Then we outgrew that space and were given what was called the band room. That was over on the East Campus, the main room, the 190 that we now occupy as our reading room. And from that time on, we just began to sort of, I guess you can't say imperialize, but we began to grow and grow and grow, and more space was given to us. The area adjacent to the band room was a series of doctor's office suites that had been at one time. So there were small offices which really weren't the perhaps the best suited for what we needed, but we made do with what we had. Eventually, we obtained two rooms for galleries here on East Campus. And as our artifact collection continued, we were also given the basement of Blackwell Library for holding our artifacts. So we have a fairly diverse setup right now. In the new building, the new Academic Commons, which is on the main campus, we'll be moving there in this summer. And all of our materials will be in one place on the fourth floor of the new building.
So, as you mentioned a moment ago, that you have the artifacts, some decorative art. Tell me a little bit about that. What kinds of art is produced here on the peninsula? Describe a few of them for me.
Well, it really is a diverse kind of sort of materials that come to us. We have not only decorative arts, but we have materials that relate to maritime life, to agricultural life, to business life, as far as domestic life, and that was really one of the first thrusts of our collection policy, and that came to us through the Wicomico Historical Society, which gave us their entire collection of artifacts and furnishings. We could furnish an entire 17th century house, a typical house, because we have all the kinds of materials that would go into that house. And would love to be able to recreate that as a view for students and for the people of the region. We also have Victorian furnishings, a good collection of Victorian furnishings, it's a wonderful collection of clothing. Particularly women's clothing. Men's clothing we don't have much of because men wore their clothing out, I think. But for the most, we do have a collection of women's clothing going back to the 1820s. And it really is a very decent collection, which we hope to be able to put on display at some time in the future.
So talking about a 17th century home, what would be in a 17th century home? What do you have that would fill it out?
Well, a 17th century home, an ordinary one, would probably have been a one room, no more than 16 to 20 feet. So the first thing you'd have would be a loom, because the women would be constantly weaving. You'd have a spinning wheel, perhaps a walking wheel to make the thread for the loom. There would be a variety of household utensils, strainers, and spatulas, and that sort of thing. There would be, other than that, there are not a lot of pieces of furniture. We do have some wonderful pieces of linen press from the Eastern Shore of Virginia, Eastern Shore white pine corner cupboard as well. Those would probably be early 18th rather than 17th. But I think we could pretty much recreate the ambience of a 17th and early 18th century home as well.
So turning to some of the books, what's the oldest book you got? Do you know?
The oldest book is one from the 15th century, written in Latin. It's not, of course, an Eastern Shore book. It's just one that happened to be in the collection of Dr. Washburn. Our materials themselves are original materials, monograph-wise, are mainly early 19th century. We have a wonderful collection of ledgers, of economic ledgers, that stretch from the end of the 18th century into the end of the 19th century and provide a really wonderful overview of the economic transformation that is happening here on Delmarva. Interestingly enough, in one of those sets of economic ledgers, there were women's ledgers that were kept just for women's purchases. That was in Mardella. There were other books that were kept for the men who came into the store, but it's kind of interesting because I think that there aren't many places in the U.S. that you'd find that separate accounting that took place here. We also have a whole series of ledgers that stretch from Dorchester County in the west to Worcester, the seaside of Worcester in the east, and down into Accomack. The earliest one of those, now that I think about it, is from the late 1600s, and it is from Accomack County. And it stretches from 1670s into the early 1700s.
What book or document is that?
Well, it starts out as a surveyor's book and ends up being an economic ledger.
Is that right? What do they do? What do they keep, or what kind of records do they keep?
Well, the economic records that are kept are by individual. Whenever a person came into the store or the shop, their name is recorded, and what purchases they made, which would be there wouldn't be a lot. There sometimes would be fabric. Sometimes it would be various kinds of produce is not available locally, but those things will be listed in the way in which how much the material cost and how it's paid.
These early documents, what do they tell us, you think, about what life was like back then? Obviously much different than it is now. And how insulated was it, do you think?
Well, I think that the Eastern Shore was not nearly as isolated as we might tend to think. There has been a prevailing view that this was a backwater area, that this was an area that was sort of out of the main thrust of the U.S. But what we've been discovering is that there were connections, strong connections, with families here on the Eastern Shore, with, for example, George Washington's family on the Western Shore, and other families of that caliber. So it wasn't that this was an area that was cut off. The major mode of transportation would have been by boat. So between here and to the Western Shore really wasn't all that great a distance when you think of it time-wise.
Hmm. And was life hard, do you think? What you got?
I am sure that life was very difficult. Particularly in the earliest generations, that the 17th century would have been a time in which the Eastern Shore area would have been pretty much like Frontier Dodge City. Probably wasn't a lot of governance. It was pretty wild and woolly. Certainly the court records indicate that. The kinds of things that would be taken to court for then are quite different than they are now.
What kinds of things?
If you swore, you'd be taken to court. If you wore a hat, if a man wore a hat inside a building, a court building, he would be fined. If he smoked in a public building, he would be fined. The women don't appear all that often in the court records in the way men do, but there's a lot of theft that's going on. Theft hogs.
So this is also a period, obviously, we have an African-American community, obviously coming from Africa, slave, but also free. Tell me a little bit about that.
Right. The first slaves on the Eastern Shore probably don't appear until the 1650s. And we're not exactly sure whether or not the Johnson family came to the Eastern Shore as slaves or not, but there was a Johnson family which not only became a very strong Eastern Shore black family, but they themselves became slave owners. And they moved, as did much of the population of the eastern shore of Virginia. They moved northerly into Somerset County, and then eventually up into Delaware, into Sussex County. That was a very dominant kind of pattern of movement for about 300 years, actually, on the eastern shore here. So yes, there was a strong black family unit early on. Now, by the 1830s, there was a very large, one of the largest free black populations here on the shore. The Revolutionary War and the advent of Methodism had a lot to do with freeing many of the slaves. As people became converted to Methodism, which didn't approve of slavery, they would either free their slaves in their lifetime or more often at their death. So by the 1830s, there is a large free black population on the shore. And that allows that population a kind of unique opportunity to know more about their history, since they're in the records more often than perhaps other people, blacks in other areas are.
What does documents, by the way, tell us about that relationship between, on the one hand, we have a slave population, we have a free black population? I've read that even if you were free, there are lots of restrictions. Life could be pretty dicey.
There would be restrictions. You would, as a black, you would have to carry basically citizen papers with you so that anyone who wanted to verify that you were free, you could do that, and hopefully you wouldn't lose those papers, because that was really would have been a real problem. I don't think that we see until the late 19th century, until after slavery's over, kinds of really horrible things, lynchings and that sort. There are no evidences of that early on the shore. It's only after the demise of slavery that sort of thing begins to appear.
How prominent was Jim Crow in this part?
Jim Crowism probably was as much in effect here as it was in most areas. I don't think we have as much record information of that as there are. Would be perhaps other areas, however.
So, speaking of the oldest town, and Easton, we have a project called The Hill. We did a story a few years back about it. And it sounds as if that particular site could actually be older than, say, for instance, Treme and Louisiana.
As far as we know, and I was working on that project as well, and I think the thought is now that it's 1790, perhaps the oldest free black community in America. I have not most recently been keeping up with that, but I believe that there still is work going on. And if that's the case, it's going to show that this area is either, I guess, on the cusp or perhaps different from other areas of colonial America.
How did it all get started, digging into that particular community? I mean, was there a sense that this might be the case, or was it just that they decided to start doing the archaeological digs and so on? And
I think it was just that there was a groundswell from the people of that area of the hill. They wanted to know more about it, so archaeologists began working on it. And it wasn't long before archaeologists and people working on the documentary side came together and realized, hey, this is older than we think it is, and it's much more important. So I suspect that kind of thing is going to be happening elsewhere. As you know, down here in our area, there were free communities very early on as well.
Hmm. In fact, I remember seeing, there's a house I can think actually down in Easton on the Hill that they think was born by, actually owned by a free black woman. I think she supposedly bought it maybe in 1792, and she was very clear that she was free, and I guess she bought her children out as well. It was actually a fairly prominent member of the community. I mean, it seems as if that there's a prominence that they even, you know, even though obviously this is, you weren't full citizens, that right. that these individuals could really play a prominent role in their communities.
Yes, that's the case not only with African Americans, but now that you mention it, with women as well. Hmm. There was much more freedom here on the shore than there was in other areas. Very early on, women on the Eastern Shore exercised a freedom which was unknown in other areas of colonial America. They had the right to make probates on their own. They, as long as they were not married, they were remarried. They had control of their land, which is something that's not usual, because usually it's held by another male member of the family. So women and blacks here, from an early time, I think, experienced more freedoms, more ability to move among the social units of society.
Hmm. Before we leave this, how much of an issue was the idea of slave traders coming in and picking up either free blacks or what have you and sending them south? We did a recent a show on Patty Cannon, of course. It's probably the most infamous along those lines. Yeah. How prevalent was that? Or do we know?
I don't know, other than the Patty Cannon stories, right. which are legendary. I think she's probably the primary candidate. There were other people who, as the Civil War began to loom on the horizon, began to sell their slaves south, or actually to move themselves with their whole slave families down south into Alabama and Mississippi. But I don't know that I just am not aware of any large-scale activity of that sort here on the shore.
Hmm. By the way, you also should mention Native Americans. What do we know about them, and what have you preserved in
well,
your
the Native American, we've had an exhibit on the Native Americans, which was one of the most popular exhibits of all the exhibits we've had, Native Americans of First Contact. And what we were trying to do was to showcase what life was like here on Delmarva for the various Native American tribal populations at the time of the first European migrations into the area. So we used our artifact collection, which was, as you might guess, primarily stone and bone, and created a rather extensive exhibit that explained what life was like using the records. You might be surprised to find that the Native Americans are quite frequently found in the early records. Down on the eastern shore of Virginia, there was a Native American emperor whose will in 1654 was recorded. So early on, they were becoming a part of the Anglo majority society by having their records placed in the courthouses as well. And one of the sad things about the Native Americans was that they didn't understand the European concept of landholding, as you might guess. And so they thought, we like this person, we'll give them land. They didn't probably understand that giving land meant that they were going to fence land in, or that there was no longer going to be free for them to wander around in and trap and trade as they had in the past. So it led to some unfortunate events later on.
Turning to watermen, that's a whole culture, and I've talked to a number of folks in those families, and they obviously see a decline in the number of folks who participate. What was life like for the watermen in those early years? I mean, at one point, obviously, the oyster harvest, for example, there were millions upon millions of bushels, which, mm-hmm. of course, now has disappeared. What was that like?
Well, for the watermen, that period of time was really a pretty, I think I could say, militant way of life. There were Oyster Wars. You're probably aware
That's right.
that Oyster Wars took place. And many of the there was a struggle between the Virginia oysters and the Maryland oysters, as well as interlopers coming in. We do know from the records that there was a policy of impressment, that young men from Baltimore were often brought, were perhaps offered too much to drink, and then they were brought on board and impressed into some of the oyster navy, so to speak. As far as having feuds, family feuds of watermen, I don't know that that existed, but there was certainly a lot of uncertainty on the part of watermen. A lot of watermen, as you know, probably didn't swim. So being on the water and not knowing how to swim was not good if the weather was particularly bad.
I mean, one of the things that struck me as I've talked to the watermen is they remind me of, and for lack of a better word, remind me of the cowboys out in the West. That is, they're very individualistic. They made their living, you know, by their own hand. That there's it seemed to create a culture of individualism. At the same time, they created a community because they all relied upon one another as well.
Absolutely. And I think that idea of individualism is something that is very strong, not only in the watermen, but in many of the people of early Delmarva. It certainly is a feature that we see in the 17th century and continuing on into the 20th century. So that's a good point, individualism. Certainly watermen are very individualistic, very independent.
How does the exhibits that you have, what kind of exhibits do you have for them? Because I know we have, for instance, the Ward Museum, which has specializes in the decoys.
Well, one of the exhibits that we had wasn't, I guess, specifically for watermen, but we had an exhibit that was very popular called Shanty Boats and Gunning Clubs on the Seaside. And it related to particularly the duck hunting that was going on. A lot of wealthy people from the metropolitan areas of the north would come down here, and eventually there would be shanty boats that were created for them to stay the weekends, and then later on more permanent facilities on the islands. But it was a fun thing for those people to do. They didn't really care whether they caught a lot of ducks. They were well off. They didn't need to do that. It was just a way of entertaining themselves and showing that they were perhaps a little better off than most. Now, many of the locals who were involved in that were not a part of that particular social facet.
Because I've read that in the early years of the peninsula, that there would be so many ducks that flying over that literally the sky would be black.
Exactly. And that in the 17th century, in the early records of the explorers, we see that again and again. I'm sure that that was the case even in the late 19th century when these folks were coming down to hunt. We have records of people who said that they could, with one shot, shoot 17 or 18 ducks. So now whether that's apocryphal or not, I suppose, is another matter. But I think there were huge numbers of ducks and birds coming through this area.
One of the things that struck me, and I was curious about, and I don't know whether you're covers this, but what kind of impact did the bridge have on this peninsula? You're talking about, I know, as this peninsula as being a sort of a whole, that it's not really just three separate states, but it's an integrated community. What kind of impact do you think that had?
The bridge?
The bridge, yeah.
Oh, well, I can only say that when I moved here in 1972, the secretary of the president of the university said to me that when she had moved here from the Western Shore, that would have been about 20 years before, just before the bridge was built, her mother said to her, "I'll never see you again." And that stuck with me, that lady, you know, we're not so far away, but she felt that she wouldn't see her. And it's interesting because I guess by that time, steamboats weren't around, which had previously provided a very easy communication between here and the Western Shore. So by that time, it did seem isolated, I think. Isn't that interesting that by the 50s, late 40s, early 50s, the time when we think of modernization taking place, this is the area, this is the time when this area began to think of itself as very separate and isolated. And of course, I don't know how long you've lived here, but I know one of the first things that we noticed in 72 when we moved here was a news article in the local newspaper saying that this area was going to form a separate state called Arcadia or perhaps Sylvania. So that wasn't the first time. This had gone on. There were a number of attempts or threats of that sort of thing.
Do you get any sense, since you here since the 70s, you had a sense about how the peninsula has changed?
Well, it certainly has. It certainly has changed. There are probably many more come heres than there are from heres now. When I moved here, my chair's wife told us that we'd probably never be accepted in society here. Not that we ever thought we were going to be, but it was something I was kind of shocked to be told, because at that time, if you were not from here, I guess there was a belief that you were somehow not acceptable. But we've not found that to be the case. And maybe that's because in the last 30 or 40 years, there have been so many people from the outside who have moved down to this area, and it's become much less homogeneous area.
We've been speaking with Ray Thompson. He is retiring this year and was one of the founders of the NAB Center, which has a collection of historical documents, artifacts, and a great deal more. And no doubt it'll continue to expand, I assume, as well.
Yes, we're hoping that we'll continue to grow with the new building, the new location. We're anticipating lots of people coming in and lots more use.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.
Hi, this is Steve Martin, the host of Unreal Bluegrass. Each week we'll bring you a wide range of bluegrass, from the innovative artists of today to the traditional pickers from yesteryear. All this and interviews with players from all walks of life. That's 3 hours of Unreal Bluegrass every Sunday at 7 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
The World Cafe, what is it? Live interviews and music with artists from genres as diverse as indie rock and jazz, folk and funk. New music and new bands on every show, all presented with wit, warmth, and intelligence. I'm David Dye. If you already know that's what we do on every World Cafe, then tell a friend to join you for Public Radio's most listened to popular music program, The World Cafe.
Weeknights at 6 on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.